And in his mid-30s, he started climbing mountains, finally submitting Sisa Padma at 8,000 meters in the Tibetan Himalayas in 1998 at age 50. And as he explains, obtaining the dubious distinction of first beaten fingers, which is a very tough mountaineer, he's very proud of. So he has climbed mountains in many parts, Africa, Argentina, Alaska, US, New Zealand, and of course, Mount Karsten. So he's here today to share his experience there with us. So I prepare.
Thanks very much, Victor. Well, I must say we went to Karstens for a totally different reason. West Papua, or Hirinjaya, whichever you like to call it, had no real history for us or background at all, other than it Karstens, which was one of the seven summits. And this attracted a lot of interest in mountaineers. And so I knew very little about the area, except it was remote and it was amazing mountain to climb. I'd heard about the mine, but didn't really appreciate what it was. I was very keen, in fact, to walk in, but we went in 2001 and it was regarded that time as being very dangerous, and there was a security issue, so we couldn't. We had an Indonesian adventure group that was taking us in, and we in fact flew from Jakarta to Timika on the coast. Now, the mountain is about 70 kilometers inland from this coastal plain. And let's just see if I can move it on. This one? Oh, just do it there. Okay. So eventually we all got together, and you can see quite a motley crew of people. Frankie was our guide. Jeff, who was a very close mate of mine, was trying to do the seven summits. I wasn't. I just went along for the ride, so to speak. And the group, in fact, had quite a variety of skills. And at that time, I can tell you, we didn't appreciate that Karstens was actually quite rocky, quite tricky, that it did have snow, that it did have ice. It was rope work to get up there. So I think we were quite naive about the mountain at the time. What was interesting, we arrived in Timika, and you cannot believe it, because you've got this deep bush, deep forest, and it's been cleared. Part of it, it's been cleared, and this is quite a good example. This is a golf course. So out of the bush, they've got this this golf course for the Americans who come to work at the mine, and particularly management. And in fact, it's still quite boggy, it's still quite damp, that whole area. And we also landed up at the American village, and had some R&R before we started off. There was the Sheraton Hotel had been built there, and in fact, we went out and there was a beautiful pool. We started to play around, and you can see some of the local vegetation, but it was all so carved out. That was the first sort of sense of people imposing themselves on the environment. And we were stuck there for a little while, because what we were told by our guides is that we were going to helicopter up to the base camp, up to Zebra Wall, which you'll see in a moment. But in fact, we're then told that there were new pilots and they didn't like to go that high, to 3,800 meters on the helicopter. In fact, what had happened, the army needed the helicopter, so it disappeared. In fact, the whole thing, when I think back of it, we were absolutely unaware of what was happening in the background. Because eventually they negotiated, our tourist group, who I think I should remain nameless, negotiated with some army people. And in the end, what they did is provide us with army vehicles. At the dead of night, under the cloak of darkness, And we felt like illegal refugees, I can tell you, trying to get up to the mountain. And we left like 10:40 in the evening in vehicles that were blacked out. We were told to put down our, we had beanies, to put them down, and we went through various checkpoints going up through towards the actual mining area. And I had glimpses outside, and you could just see vaguely absolute desolation because we were going up the, near the river. And it was absolutely clear that this was area which had suffered from some sort of amazing kind of poison or whatever, because it just was quite desolate right near a river, which in fact should have the deepest, most significant forests. Anyway, we got up and eventually we landed up in the village, in the town, which services the mine. You've got to remember this, you're talking now at about 3,000 meters, and it's wet and boggy. The town looks like sort of just units, unit blocks. And we arrived in the street, suddenly you've got tarred roads, and we suddenly, again, cloak of darkness, ushered into a little building, into a unit, and you know everyone's watching. We've got army people with guns, and this is not what I was actually expecting on a mountain climb. And they put out some, and we managed to rest for about an hour. This was now about 3 a.m, and a whole lot is still happening in the background under this cloak of darkness. Eventually, these four-wheel drives arrive, massive four-wheel drives. We get into them again, very secretively, straight into these vehicles, and off we go. And we cut through the entire mine. It was absolutely amazing. Through the tunnels that have been dug into the earth, right through it, and we could see much better then because we were in normal four-wheel drives with windows. It was quite extraordinary. I couldn't believe it. Right through security. And the army was guiding us through this. I never thought in my life I'd depend on the Indonesian army for my safety. And in fact, there were some capacious people there as well. But at that stage, we were totally in their hands. And eventually, we arrived at a gully. Now, here's the mine site. It's massive. It's just, it's one of the largest copper gold mines in the world. And you come up this gully, so we just got out of the mine. Now, this is like early morning. It's very wet, and that just gives you an idea of that is not the mountain, in fact. It's this side, which you'll see. Karstens, that's other parts of the ridge. And we arrive at what is known as the Zebra Wall, which is the first cap. Now we're at 3,800 meters. And it looks sort of fairly much like terra firma, but it is absolutely boggy and damp. In fact, we put down our tent in what we thought was a dry spot, and we got onto our sleeping bags, and it was a waterbed. It's just sort of floating along. It is so wet. It is amazing. And the other thing we quickly realized, it rains and almost nonstop for days of rain. So we went up from that's the Zebra Wall. That's some of the people. We had Vicky, who was from Scotland, who was in fact doing the Seven Summits. He was one of the real mountaineers, in fact. He was a mountain guide who was in fact brought a fellow from England, from America, who he was taking up. And it was very fortunate he was there because, in fact, our guides, our Indonesian mountain guides, they were okay, but the one thing they didn't actually guide. They I think it must be a cultural issue. They didn't feel that they could tell you what to do and how to do it and when to do it. So in fact, they weren't really guiding much, but he set the ropes and helped us enormously to get up. These were some, we just had visitors occasionally who would come and we'd serve them food and they'd just come and visit us. Very little communication at that time. In terms of language, we managed to get a few porters, and as you can see, the women were doing the portering, took us up, but we, in fact, by the time we got up to close to the next camp, There were no porters, so we were virtually carrying most of our stuff at that time. It was pretty deserted at that time. Some of the, again, the ladies who were helping us. And it just gives you an idea of the conditions. You can see umbrellas and stuff. Very, very wet, incredibly damp. I just want to say one thing about the mine. One of the reasons, you know, when they first built that mine, in fact, even landing in Timica, they had to use helicopters to land with massive platforms from which to actually start engineering works. It is so damp. And up at that stage, they try to build tailing dams to contain the tailings. Now, the waste tailings are quite lethal because a lot of, for copper gold mines, you leach out the copper and gold using arsenic. So this was the process. And in many copper gold mines, they in fact put them in massive tailing dams and treat them. You can't contain anything up there. The walls are going to break down with the wet. So what they landed up doing, which apparently they did in Ok-Tedi as well, is float the tailings down the river system. And all that devastation we saw was basically these tailings coming down. The river system comes all the way down to Timica. So that really is one of the major reasons that you've got that tremendous devastation and the total pollution of the water below the mine. We eventually got to these lakes. Now, it was interesting because I think you were quite near there,
yes.
But you can see there's no ice, no snow, all gone. This is now 2001, 30 years later. And we camped on the side here of this very beautiful lake. But what was also very interesting, I was hiking up there and I said to my Indonesian guide, "Can we drink the water?" And he said, "Absolutely." I said, but don't people use the water, you know, to wash? And he said, water for the local people is sacred. And they would never pollute the water. He says, if you go to the mine and below the mine, that's where the pollution starts. But you can very safely drink that water. It's the purest water. That's another view from the tent. But you can see the conditions are just very, very misty and very grey. And here now we're going, we were camping there, now we're going up towards the major plateau for the summit. And this gives you some images. So we've gone up there, you can see once you get on to the major wall, it then becomes rock and rock climbing and rope work. So we're now, that I think that, again, was part of the area you might have spent. That's what was left in 2001. I suspect there's not much of that left now. So we still saw, but that's the glacier. It's across the valley. We never went near the glacier. We never, in fact, did any glacial travel. I think that gives you a very good idea of where the climb is. I can't remember exactly where, but we would go up one of these, or one of these somewhere around here. Then you go across the plain and up, and then the summit is here. Once you think once you're up to here, you're almost there. But in fact, that's where the climb really got tough, because it's a series of knife-edge ridges. So you're actually down climbing and then climbing up again. And there were a few crevasses up there. That's that flat plain. As I said, you're now up onto the plain and you're cutting up across onto the ridges. And there's some of the ridges that you're starting to climb up. And as you can see, helmets were absolutely essential. It became quite an epic because some of the people who were with the group had absolutely no technical experience. So we actually, the friend Jeff and I got up at about 2:30 that afternoon. By the way, we had started at 3:30 in the morning. So we actually got to the summit at about 2:30 that afternoon, climbing up these various gullies and rock ridges. And eventually, there it is, the summit. And we actually got down and we got back onto this ridge, this area there. And In fact, the others were nowhere to be seen, except the two Americans who had climbed very fast. And we were lost. In fact, our guides were dealing with them. So we in fact spent till about 9 o'clock at night waiting for them. And it was the one night, it was so fortunate, it was the one night that we actually didn't have rain. It was a beautiful night on the mountain. I'll never forget it. It was absolutely, it was almost clear. You could almost see the stars in the sky. It was a beautiful night. Anyway, we then came down, and we got down at about 11 o'clock that night. The rest came down in the morning. They'd actually bivouacked on the mountain, which is quite tricky to do, particularly when it's so wet. Anyway, we then came down and reversed the process, came back to that zebra wall, and expecting back down the gully, waiting for the army to meet us again. But in fact, when these vehicles arrived, they were not the army. They were Freeport security. And our Indonesian guide suddenly realized this could be catastrophe. And what they did, and it was amazing, because they turned to that Scottish girl, Vicky, and they said, "Vicky, you're not well, are you?" And she realized straight away this was absolutely, she's going to have to feign sickness. She said, "I'm very, very ill. I'm so sick." And they said, "Look, we've come down because we've got a sick person. And can Freeport Mine help us?" I must tell you, they are absolutely hostile to mountaineers and to anyone coming in. They are so scared of negative publicity. So what in fact... They actually then said to us, "Well, they'll check whether they can treat her in the hospital." We knew there was going to be no hope. All we wanted to do was have an excuse as to why we were waiting there at the bottom of the gully where the mine site is. And anyway, they said, of course, they can't help us. And so we said, "Oh, well, we'll get the helicopter tomorrow." And we started to walk away. And they went saved, very lucky, because if they got an idea that we were going to go through that mine, we'd have been detained straight away. There was no question. But, I was sitting on that ridge just looking down. I'll never forget it. And, you know, it was like a moonscape. There were these massive dump trucks with these huge lights, like almost creatures in the night, this mist and this absolutely desolate landscape. It was quite extraordinary. Anyway, we did eventually come down again. We waited in the gully, in the shadows. Out came the... Eventually, some more vehicles arrived. It was the army. They were running late. And they picked us up and once again reversed that process. We again stopped at the village and eventually got back to Timika, absolutely exhausted now, because we'd spent two nights, up almost the whole night. And thinking, we'll just have this wonderful rest. And we arrived at the hotel thinking about that Sheraton Hotel, going back and sitting at the pool. And about 6:30, this is now 6:30 in the morning, suddenly our Indonesian guards, "We've got to get out of here." Why? Oh, they're expecting trouble. Again, the intrigue. It wasn't true. What had happened, we later found out, is that some of the army knew that we were being taken up and some didn't. And questions were being asked. And in fact, they knew that we were in serious danger of being, in fact, detained at that stage. So there's a mad dash, left our luggage, just straight to the airport. And I tell you, I felt like, Humph Bogart in Casablanca, just sort of waiting for the plane, thinking, "Where's the army? They're about to come." And when we got onto that plane, heading off to back to Jakarta, it was with absolute relief. So it was an amazing adventure, in fact, of a mountain that I thought was just going to be having to deal with the mountain, not this entire political, social landscape that we suddenly were confronted with. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a really, really, really interesting adventure. I'm making the idea for some moments. I always wonder, you know, when you see mountaineers' expeditions going to certain countries, and they are very focused, of course, on the mountain and the climbing, and that's why they are there. But I wonder, does a mountaineer detach himself from the whole context around him or her, or like you were talking about the political, social context, and just focus on the mountain, do the thing, and go? Or is it kind of something that affects you somehow?
You know, it's actually, Victor, it's a very interesting question, because I think you start out, can you all hear me? You start out being very motivated by the mountain. Definitely. I think, especially when you're in the Himalayas, you just, you know, the idea of climbing to those heights, folk, and your sense of self, the risks that you face yourself, tends to absorb you almost entirely. You're absorbed by the weather. The weather conditions are critical. So you tend to, you do become absorbed with the climb and the whole daily routine and the exhaustion, of course, from altitude and from the weather and from... But when you're there long enough, you do become aware, and especially because, and in the Himalayas, more than in fact happened to us there, they're local people, they're porters, they're guides that come and help you, and you start building up relationships, and then you start a complete new awareness. And it's quite interesting, because again, I stress Nepal and the Himalayas, there've been a number of fantastic mountaineers that have climbed some of the highest peaks that have devoted themselves to helping the local people in these countries, like in Nepal. In fact, and I don't know whether you know, but Ed Hillary was amazing. He spent most of his life, after climbing Everest, raising money and going out himself and building schools in various villages in Nepal. And there are many mountaineers that do that. I think once you're in the country, you get touched by the people. But I don't think that's how it starts.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Any questions for Rob?
No? Just wondering, before you had the map there and you showed those with knife edge,
ridges, yes,
to get up. Just wondering, how big was your last day before you had to summit? Where was your last
camp? Well, the Zebra Wall. You remember we had the Zebra Wall? We acclimatized at the Zebra Wall for about 2 days. And we did an acclimatization walk up to those lakes where the base camp was and came back again. So you're talking about 3,800 to about 4,200 and back again and then back up. And then the first night, then we were going to make the bed from there, so the summit bed. The first night we tried, in fact, it just was freezing. It was snowing. There was no way we could make a bed. So we spent the whole night up and didn't go for the summit. I hardly slept the next day, and the next night we did it again, and it wasn't raining. So we went for it. And that was it. Straight from, so it was about 3,000, no, that's 4,200 now, and straight from there to 4,800. Once you make the bed, you're pretty well committed then. You know, you don't sort of find... And 600 metres is about as much as you would want to go on a summit bed. That is quite extending it. But where you saw that, you know, that plain of flat ice, that was probably around 200 metres from the summit. So we'd done most of the climbing a bit lower than that.
You said the group got separated.
Yes.
So the group divvied out.
And we
didn't have communication, you didn't
know. No, we didn't. We broke up into three groups. The two Americans, particularly with the technical climber, were the fastest and went straight ahead. There was myself and Jeff, who's the guy who's done the seven summits, plus a guide. And we went off and we were separate. And then the rest came. And there were all sorts of terrible problems. I tell you, it's quite a dangerous mountain. In fact, the Japanese man you saw, Kenji, he actually fell about 4 meters. Off a ridge. He didn't clip on properly onto the rope when he was down climbing. And he was so lucky, because he fell into a little gully which was full of snow, and he fell onto the snow and was okay. But we went our own pace. But one of the most beautiful memories I do have of the mountain was not the summit. It was sitting there waiting in the evening, just in this light period. And I don't think we could see the mine from there, but it was quite dark and very beautiful. And just sitting on the rocks waiting for a guide, because we didn't know where to down to climb. At night you lose your way, and we couldn't see very clearly, so we waited.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Ralph.
Thanks.